Welcome to Fairbanks Arts Review. I'm your host, Robert Gilfillan. On tonight's show, we'll hear a special program about a Canadian humorist.
I might mention that my fee for a lecture on humor is quite reasonable. I find out how much money you've got, and I never charge a cent more.
And examine what it takes to be a jazz dancer.
You have to have a lot of guts and a lot of spunk to make it in a dance where there are just too many people out there. So you really have to have a lot of aggressive energy to, if you want it, you go for it. You don't sit back and wait for somebody to hand it to you.
We start our show with something unusual tonight. Here at the station, we frequently receive programs and records that deserve airing, but are hard to place in our schedule. Recently, I listened to one of these recordings and decided to use one of my programs to present it to you. It's called An Evening with Stephen Leacock. It was recorded live at the National Arts Center in Ottawa in 1980, and it's introduced here by Gordon Pinsent.
If laughter is the best medicine, Stephen Leacock has been doctored to millions of happy patients around the world. At home, his Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town remains a Canadian bestseller 69 years after it was first published in 1912. His books can be found in libraries from St. John's to Los Angeles, from Paris to Moscow, and back to Orillia. In his extremely productive lifetime, Leacock wrote more than 50 humorous and academic books, became head of the Department of Economics and Political Science at Montreal's McGill University, traveled North America and Britain as a highly paid public performer, and in the process carved himself a good slice of the pie of posterity. In characteristic style, Leacock said of his accomplishments, "I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it." Before going to the National Arts Center in Ottawa for a live recreation of the Leacock performance, here is the voice of the man from a rare recording made by the CBC in 1943, talking about his old college.
This opening year, 1943, marks the 100th anniversary of our actual teaching on the campus. Till then, there was no money to teach on, and, this is literal history, the authorities rented the college grounds to a farmer who worked the university on half and half, best terms it's ever had. The farmer bought $15 worth of seeds for the flower beds on the campus. The college couldn't pay for the seeds and began life with a deficit. They never paid for the seed, but they gave the farmer an honorary degree, and he said, generous fella, that he thought it was worth it. But oh my, what flowers have grown since from those seeds on the McGill campus. Boys, we must keep the weeds out of them.
Stephen Leacock was at his best in front of a live audience, in the classroom or on the international lecture circuit. Now we take you to a theater where Leacock would have been very proud to perform, Canada's National Arts Centre in Ottawa. Here, recorded in live performance, is actor John Stark in his internationally acclaimed one-man show, An Evening with Stephen Leacock.
In domine confido, is what a colleague of mine, McGill, keeps saying to me. Well, many of my colleagues attach a great deal of importance to the study of the classics. I don't mind confessing that I, for a long time, been very skeptical about them, especially when a professor of Greek I know told me the classics have made him what he is. This is a very serious charge against the classics and should not too readily be accepted. In my opinion, some of these men would have been what they are no matter what they were. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Professor Leacock. I was born in Swanmore, England, December the 30th, 1869. I'm not aware that there was any particular conjunction of the planets at the time, but I consider it extremely likely. After graduating from Upper Canada College and the University of Toronto, I took to school teaching, the only trade I could find that needed neither experience nor intellect. That being the lowest paid profession in the world, I decided to compensate myself for it by becoming a humorist. Now, I might mention that my fee for a lecture on humor is quite reasonable. I find out how much money you've got, and I never charge a cent more. I should mention that I'm a great believer in prohibition. I think that a glass of water, especially a cold, clear glass of water, I don't care for muddy water, is a beautiful drink. So limpid and transparent, almost like gin. Having a PhD after my name, I've often been mistaken for a medical doctor. This was on a recent voyage to Great Britain. It so happened there was a very young, attractive woman on board who had injured her knee. And the steward discovered there was a Dr. Leacock aboard. Came frantically knocking on my cabin room door and said, Dr. Leacock, there's a young lady up in 213 that's injured her knee. I wonder if you can give her a hand. Well, unfortunately, by the time I had got to her, a doctor of divinity was already seeing to her. I've toured in many countries as a public lecturer. And what always infuriates me is the attitude of certain immigration officials. Now, I finally discovered how to solve the problem when an English official asked me what my political beliefs were. "Let me say," I said, "that I am an anarchistic polygamist. That I'm opposed to all forms of government, that I object to any kind of revealed religion, that I regard the state, property, and marriage as a tyranny of the bourgeoisie, and that I want to see class hatred carried to the point where it forces everyone into brotherly love." "You're not Irish, are you, sir?" This introduction was used against me by a chairman in England.
Not so long ago, ladies and gentlemen, we sent out to Canada various members of our community to help build up that country. We sent out our laborers, we sent out our scholars and professors, we sent out our criminals. And now,
with a wave of his hand toward me,
they are coming back.
Man called on me the other day with an idea of insuring my life. Now, I detest life insurance agents. They're always arguing that I am going to one day die, which is not so. I've been insured a great many times for as long as a month at a time, and I've never had any luck with it at all. So I decided to outwit this man in his own game. I let him talk straight ahead, encouraged him all I could, until he finally left me with a sheet of questions, which I was to answer as an applicant. I spread the sheet of questions before me and drew up a set of answers which I hoped would settle forever all doubt as to my eligibility for insurance. "What is your chest measurement?" 19 inches. "What is your chest expansion?" 1/2 inch. "What is your height?"
6'5", if erect. Less when on all fours.
"Is your grandfather dead?"
"Practically."
"Cause of death, if dead?"
"Dipsomania, if dead."
"Is your father dead?"
"To the world."
"Cause of death, rabies." What illnesses have you had?"
"Well, as a child, consumption, leprosy, and water on the knee. And as a man, stomach ache, whooping cough, and water on the brain."
"Have you any brothers?"
13, all nearly dead."
"Are you aware of any habits or tendencies which might be expected to shorten your life?"
"I am aware."
"Well, But they'll surprise a few days later to receive the following letter from the company. Dear sir, we beg to acknowledge your letter of application and check for $15. After a careful comparison of your case with the average modern standard, we are pleased to accept you as a first-class risk. No doubt all of you at one time or another have been to visit the photographer. Well, my recollection of the event goes as follows. I want my photograph taken. The photographer looked at me without enthusiasm.
Sit down and wait.
I waited an hour. Read the Ladies' Companion for 1912, the Girls' Magazine for 1902, and the Infants' Journal for 1888. Began to see that I had done an unwarrantable thing in breaking in on the privacy of this man's scientific pursuits with a face like mine. After an hour, the photographer opened the inner door. Come in. I went into the studio. Sit down. I sat down in a beam of sunlight filtered by a cotton sheet hung across a frosted skylight. The photographer rolled a machine into the middle of the room and then crawled into it from behind. He was only in there for a second, just long enough to get one look at me, and he was back out again, tearing at the cotton sheets and window panes with a hook stick, apparently frantic for light and air. Then he crawled back into the machine again and drew a little black cloth over himself. This time he was very quiet in there. I knew he was praying, so I kept still. The photographer came out at last. He looked very grave and shook his head.
The face is quite wrong.
I know. I've always known it.
I think the face would look better three-quarter full.
Oh, I'm sure it would. In fact, so would yours. How many faces one sees that are hard, narrow, limited? Well, the minute you get them three-quarters full, they get large, wide, almost boundless. The photographer ceased to listen to me, came over and took my head in his hands and twisted it sideways. I thought he meant to kiss me, so I closed my eyes. But I was wrong. He twisted my head sideways and then went back and looked at it.
I don't like the head. Open the mouth a little.
I started to do so.
Stop! Close it! Now, the ears are bad. Droop them a little more. Thank you. Thank you. Now the eyes. Roll them under the lids. Yeah. Put the hands on the knees. Yeah. Contract the waist. I expand the lungs. And hook the neck. Yeah. Now twist the hips slightly up towards the elbow. I still don't like the face. It is a little too full.
Now, stop. This is my face. See, it's not your face. It's mine. I've lived with it for 45 years, and such as it is, I've learned to love it. And if your machine is too narrow, click. The photographer had pulled the string. The photograph taken, I could see the machine still staggering from the shock.
I think I got the features in just the right moment. Now, you come back on Saturday, and I show you the proof of the photo.
Well, on Saturday, I went back and he unfolded the proof. Is that me? Yeah, is that this you? Well, the eyes don't look much like mine.
Oh, I've had to retouch them a little. They're splendid, don't you think?
Oh, fine, but my eyebrows certainly don't look like that.
Oh, we have a new process now as a Delphi for putting on new ones.
Well, what about the mouth? Is that mine?
Ach, no, yours was too low. I found I couldn't use it.
Well, the ears, though, they strike me as a good likeness. They're just like mine.
Ach, but we have a new process now. The sulfite for removing the ears completely.
Hey, wait a minute now. I came here for a photograph. Something mad, though it may seem, would have looked like me. I wanted something that would have depicted my face as heaven gave it to me. Humble a gift, though it may have been. Now, you take your negative, or whatever it is you call it, and dip it in bromide, sulfide, oxide, cowhide, anything you like. Remove the eyes, correct the mouth, adjust the face, restore the lips, reanimate the necktie, and reconstruct the waistcoat. Coat it with an inch of gloss, shade it, emboss it, gild it, until even you yourself acknowledge that it is finished. And when you have done all that, you can keep it, because to me it is worthless. I broke into tears and laughed. While I was at the University of Chicago, Professor Plum said to me,
I have invented a highly concentrated form of food. Now, it has all the essential nutrients and is put together in the form of little pellets, each one containing from 100 to 200 times as much nourishment as an ordinary ounce of food. Now, these pellets, when diluted with water, will form all that is necessary to support life.
Well, I can just imagine what could happen when a smiling family gathers around a table laid plenteously with a soup plate in front of each beaming child, bucket of hot water before the radiant mother, and at the head of the table, the Christmas dinner of the happy home, warmly covered by a thimble and resting on a poker chip. The expectant whispers of the little ones are hushed as the father rises from his chair, lifts the thimble, and discloses a tiny pellet of concentrated nourishment on the chip before him. The whole Christmas dinner is right there, jammed into that little pellet and only waiting to expand. Then the father, with deep reverence and a devout eye alternating between the pellet and heaven, lifts his voice in benediction. At this moment, there's an anguished cry from the mother.
Oh, Henry, quick! Baby has snatched the pellet!
It is too true. Dear little Gustavus Adolphus, the golden-haired baby boy, has grabbed the whole Christmas dinner off the poker chip and bolted it. 350 pounds of concentrated nourishment passes down the esophagus of the unthinking child.
Slap him on the back, cries the distracted mother. Give him water.
This is a fatal idea. The water striking the pellet causes it to expand. There's a dull, rumbling sound, and then with an awful bang, Gustavus Adolphus explodes into fragments. When they pick up the pieces of the little corpse, the baby's lips are parted in a lingering smile, which could only be worn by a child that had eaten 13 Christmas dinners. I was at a cocktail party the other night, and a man came up to me and said, hey, you ever seen any card tricks? So here's a good one, pick a card. Thank you, I don't want a card.
I know, but just pick one, anyone you want, and I'll tell which one you pick.
You'll tell who?
No, I mean, I'll know which one it is, don't you see? Go ahead, pick a card.
Well, anyone I like.
Yeah.
Any color?
Yeah, yeah.
Any suit?
Yeah, go ahead, pick one.
Well, I'll pick the Ace of Spades.
Great, Caesar, you're to pull a card out of the pack.
Oh, to pull it out of the pack, and now I understand. Hand me the pack. All right, I've got it.
Did you pick one?
Yes, the Three of Hearts. Did you know it?
Hang it, don't tell me like that. You spoil it. Now try it again. Pick a card.
All right, I've got one.
Put it back in the pack.
Thank you.
Shuffle, 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 flip. There, is that it?
I don't know. I lost sight of it.
Lost sight of it? Confound it. You have to look at it and see what it is.
Oh, you want me to look at the front of it?
Why, of course. Why, of course. Now, pick a card.
All right, I've got one.
All right, shuffle, 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 shuffle. Say, did you put that card back in the pack?
Why, no, I kept it.
Holy Moses. Listen, you are to pick a card, look at it, see what it is, and then put it back. Understand?
Oh, perfectly, but I don't see how you're ever going to do it. Well, you must be awfully clever.
Shuffle, 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 flip. There you are. That's your card now, isn't it?
No, that is not my card. This is a flat lie, but heaven will forgive me for it.
Not that card, confound it. I've done this cursed thing on mother and father and anyone that's ever come around our place. Now, watch what you're doing this time. Pick a card. Shuffle, 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 flip, bang. There, that's your card.
No, I am sorry. That is not my card. But I'm afraid I've been rather stupid. Won't you try it again?
No, I gotta go home now.
So sorry. Good night. Ladies and gentlemen, so far here at the National Arts Center here in Ottawa, you have been one of the finest audiences in the world, bar none. I said the same thing yesterday in Chicago, and I'll be saying the same thing tomorrow in New York. No doubt you have all, at one time or another, witnessed hecklers disposed of by performers in some fashion. I once witnessed a conjurer dispose of a heckler in this particular fashion.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, having shown that the cloth is absolutely empty, I will proceed to take from it a bowl of goldfish. Presto!
All around the hall, the people were saying,
"Oh, how wonderful. How does he do it?"
But the quick man in the front row said to the people near him,
"Nah, he had it up his sleeve."
And all the people nodded to the quick man and said,
"Oh, of course, he had it up his sleeve." "My next trick,"
said the conjurer,
"is the famous Hindustani rings. Now, you will note that the rings are apparently separate. At a blow, they will all join. Clink, 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 clang, presto!"
There was a general buzz of stupefaction until the quick man in the front row said to the people near him,
"He had another lot up his sleeve."
And all the people repeated,
"Yeah, the rings were up his sleeve."
Brow the conjurer was clouded with a gathering frown.
"I will now show you a most amusing trick whereby I am enabled to take any number of eggs from a hat. Will some gentleman kindly lend me his hat? Thank you. Presto!"
He extracted 17 eggs, and for 35 seconds, everybody thought he was wonderful. And the quick man in the front row said to the people near him,
"He's got a hen up his sleeve."
And all the people repeated,
"He's got several hens up his sleeve."
The egg trick was ruined. It went on like this all the way through the performance. It transpired from the whispers of the quick man that the conjurer had concealed up his sleeve, in addition to the fish, rings, and hens, several packs of cards, a loaf of bread, a doll's cradle, a live guinea pig, 50-cent piece, and a rocking chair. Reputation of the conjurer was rapidly sinking below zero. At the close of the evening, he rallied for one final effort.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I will now present to you in conclusion the famous Japanese trick, invented by the natives of Tipperary." "Well, you, sir,"
said the conjurer, turning towards the quick man in the front row.
"You kindly pass me your gold watch?"
He passed it to him.
"Have your permission to put it into this mortar and pound it to pieces?"
The quick man nodded and smiled. Conjurer threw the watch into the mortar and grabbed a sledgehammer from the table. There was a sound of violent smashing.
"Slipped it up his sleeve," said the quick man. "Now, sir, will you allow me to take your handkerchief and punch holes in it? Thank you." "You see, ladies and gentlemen, the holes are visible to the eye. There is no deception."
The face of the quick man beamed. The real mystery of the thing fascinated him.
"Now, sir, will you allow me to pass me your silk hat and allow me to dance on it? Thank you."
Conjurer made a few rapid passes with his feet and exhibited the hat, crushed beyond recognition.
"And now, sir, allow me to take your collar and permit me to burn it with my candle. Thank you. And now, sir, allow me to smash your spectacles for you with my hammer. Thank you."
By this time, the features of the quick man were assuming a puzzled expression. "Well, this thing beats me. I don't see through it a bit." There was a great hush upon the audience. And the conjurer drew himself up to his full height. And with a withering look at the quick man, he concluded,
"Ladies and gentlemen, you will observe that I have, with this gentleman's permission, pounded his gold watch to pieces, punched holes in his handkerchief, danced on his silk hat, set fire to his collar, and smashed his spectacles for him. If he will give me further permission to cut his suspenders in half and paint red stripes on his underwear, I'll be delighted to do so. If not, the performance is over."
I was in a little town called Aurelia, where I often spend my summers, and a fellow in the barber shop came up to me and said,
"You know, Stevie, whenever I go into a bank, I get rattled. The clerks rattle me, the wickets rattle me, the sight of money rattles me, everything rattles me. The moment I cross the threshold of a bank and attempt to transact any business there, I become an irresponsible idiot." Well, I knew this beforehand, but my money had been raised to $50 a month, and I felt the bank was the only place for it. So I shambled in and looked timidly around at the clerks. I had an idea that a person about to open an account must needs consult the manager. I went up to a wicket marked accountant. The accountant was a tall, cool devil. The very sight of him rattled me. "Can I see the manager?" "Alone?" I don't know why I said alone.
"Certainly,"
he said, and fetched him. The manager was a grave, calm man. I held my $56 clutched in a crumpled ball in my pocket. You the manager? God knows I didn't doubt it.
Yes?
Can I see you? Alone? I don't know why I said alone again, but without it, the thing seems self-evident. Manager looked at me with some alarm. He felt I had an awful secret to reveal.
Come in here.
He said, led the way to a private room. He turned the key in the lock.
We can talk without interruption here. Sit down.
We both sat down and looked at each other. I found no voice to speak.
You're one of Pinkerton's men, I presume.
Gathered from my mysterious manner that I was a detective. I knew what he was thinking, and it made me feel worse. No, not from Pinkerton's, I said, seeming to imply I came from a rival agency. Tell you the truth, I've come to open an account. I intend to keep all my money in this bank. The manager looked relieved, but still serious. He concluded now that I was a son of Baron Rothschild or a young Rockefeller.
A large amount, I suppose?
Fairly large, I said. I propose to deposit $56 now and $50 a month, regularly. The manager got up and opened the door.
Mr. Montgomery, this gentleman intends to open an account. He will deposit $56. Good morning.
I rose. A large iron door stood open at the side of the room. Morning, I said, and stepped into the safe.
Come out,
said the manager, and showed me the other way. Went up to the accountant's wicket and thrust my crumpled ball of money at him with a quick convulsive movement as if I were doing a conjuring trick. Here, deposit it. Gave me the money and made me write the sum on a slip of paper, sign my name in a book. I no longer knew what I was doing. The bank swam before my eyes. Is it deposited, I said?
It is.
Then I want to draw a check. My idea was to draw out $6 of it for present use. Somebody gave me a checkbook to sign. Somebody else began telling me how to write it out. The people in the bank had the impression I was an invalid millionaire. I wrote something on the check and thrust it back in at the clerk. He looked at it.
What? Are you drawing it all out again?
Then I realized what I had done. I'd written 56 instead of 6. I was too far gone to reason now. I felt it was impossible to explain the thing. All the clerks had stopped writing to look at me. Reckless with misery, I made the plunge. Yes, the whole thing!
You withdraw all your money from the bank?
Every cent of it?
Are you not going to deposit any more?
Never! Any hope struck me they might think something had insulted me while I was writing the check, and it made me change my mind. I made a wretched attempt to look like a man with a fearfully quick temper. Clerk prepared to pay the money.
How will you have it?
What?
How will you have it?
50s.
And the 6.
Sixes. As the big door swung behind me, I heard an echo of a roar of laughter that went up to the ceiling of the bank. Well, since then, I bank no more. Keep my money in cash in my trousers pocket, and my savings in silver dollars in a sock.
Have you ever been to Paris with somebody from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan?
I have.
Take it from me, said my friend from Moose Jaw, leaning back in his chair at the Tavern Royale. Don't talk no French here in Paris. They don't expect it, and they don't even seem to understand it.
The man from Moose Jaw, mind you, had a right to speak. He knew French. He had learned French. He told me so himself. Good French at the Moose Jaw Classical Academy. Later on, he'd learned the natural method from an expert in Regina. Cost him 50 cents a throw. But in France, something seemed to go wrong with his Moose Jaw French.
Well, I guess what most of them speak here is a sort of patois.
Now, when he said patois, I knew just what he meant. It was equivalent to saying he couldn't understand it. I had seen him coming up against patois before. There was a French steward on the steamer coming over, and the man from Moose Jaw, after a couple of attempts, had said there was no use talking French to that man. He spoke a hopeless patois. There were half a dozen cabin passengers, too, from Quebec City. And they were not speaking French either, but a form of patois. Well, it was the same thing coming through Normandy. Patois everywhere. A sort of abbot showed us around. Would you believe it? That man spoke patois, straight patois, the very worst kind, and fast. And when we arrived in Paris, my friend summoned a waiter to our table and spoke very slowly, syllable by syllable, so as to give the man every chance. Bring him moi de la soupe, de la fiche, and de la roast porque, and de la fromage. Right, all sure, roast pork, fish, and a little cheese on the side. The waiter was raised in Prince Edward Island and had come to Paris to seek his fortune. One day we met a real Frenchman. There are some even in Paris. It was night and we were trying to find our way about. Monsieur, my friend asked, s'il vous plaît, which is the direction for aller à Arc de Triomphe? Il y a ce projet de direction, c'est à vous gauche, n'est-ce pas? Merci. And we made a sharp right, walked four blocks, and found ourselves before the Folies Bergère. We had no choice but to spend the evening there, practicing our French, of course. Recent trip to the United States, I made the mistake of telling the customs officer that I thought communism was okay. In heaven, where they don't need it, and in hell, where they've already got it. As I said, I'm a great believer in prohibition, and I'm very fascinated during this period of prohibition with cities like Toronto. Now, I'm from Montreal, which, as you know, is wet. And I was traveling to Toronto, which you know is dry. The man next to me on the train apparently noticed my parched look. You, sir, I take it, are not from Toronto. No, I'm from Montreal. Ah, from Montreal. Are you drunk? No, I don't think so. But you are suffering for a drink. You need one, eh? You already feel a kind of craving, eh? No, the fact is, it's rather early in the morning. Quite so, but I understand that in Montreal, all the saloons are open at 7 a.m., and even at that hour, they're crowded, eh? Well, I think that's a kind of an exaggeration. In fact, we always try to avoid crowding and jostling. It is generally understood that as a matter of politeness, that the first place in line is given to the clergy. Come with me. The man grabbed my elbow. We walked through Union Station, and at the outer door, there stood a group of hotel busmen and porters with thirsty looks on their faces. Far too thirsty to be able to carry any baggage. We were barely upon the street when I realized the profound change total prohibition had effected. Everywhere were bright, smiling faces of working people, laughing and singing at their tasks, and, early though it was, cracking jokes and asking one another riddles as they worked. I noticed one man, evidently a city employee, in a rough white suit, busily hosing down the street and singing to himself. Little drops of water, little grains of sand, tra-la-la-la-la-la-la, prohibition's grand. Why do they sing like that, I asked. They can't help it. They haven't had a drink of whiskey in 4 months. Amazing, amazing. Why, in Montreal, people never sing. They're too busy drinking. Exactly. My friend's determined, satisfied face indicated we were on the same wavelength. At a street crossing, we were brought to a halt by a great block of vehicles. What are all these drays, I asked. Surely those are barrels of whiskey. So they are. Export whiskey. Fine sight, isn't it? It must be, what, 25 loads of it. This place, sir, mark my words, is going to prove with its new energy and enterprise one of the greatest seats of the distillery business. In fact, the whiskey capital of the North.
Yeah, but I thought that whiskey was prohibited here last September.
Export whiskey, my dear sir. Not at all for home consumption. You see, we merely import it from Montreal, so the sin of selling it rests solely on their heads. We import it, then immediately export it. Import, export, a plain matter of business.
Well, it does seem a pity, though, that with all this alcohol around, an unregenerate sinner like myself should be prevented from getting a drink.
Well, a drink. If you please, step this way.
He pulled me by the sleeve through a side door and into a large, long room.
Why, this is a bar. Nonsense. Bars in this province are forbidden. We've done away with the foul things forever. This is an import shipping company's delivery office. But this long counter. No, it's not a counter. That's a desk. And that bartender in his white jacket. Sir, he's not a bartender. He's an import clerk.
What'll you have, gentlemen? Said the import clerk, pushing a glass as he spoke.
Two whiskeys and a soda, long ones.
The import clerk mixed the drinks and set them on the table.
Dreadful, isn't it?
My friend handed me one of the whiskeys.
The sunken, depraved condition of your city of Montreal, actually selling whiskey to the temperate citizens of Toronto. With that, he raised his glass. To prohibition.
To prohibition, I said.
Little drops of water, little grains of sand, tra-la-la-la-la-la-la, prohibition's grand.
A reporter came up to me just after I'd finished giving my address, his notebook open in his hand.
Now, would you mind telling me the main points of your address? I didn't get to hear it.
You weren't at the lecture.
No, I was at the hockey game.
Reporting it.
No, I don't report on those sort of things. I only do the lectures and the highbrow stuff. What'd you say your lecture was about?
No, it was called The Triumphal Progress of Science.
Science, eh? Say, how do you spell triumphal? Is that with a P-H or an F? Now, would you mind telling me just the principal idea? You know, the main thing here, address.
Well, I was speaking of our advanced knowledge of radiating emanations and the light it throws on the theory of atomic structure.
Hey, wait a minute till I get that. Is that R-A-D-I-A? And the light it throws, eh? Well, I guess I got that. You ever been here before?
No, this is my first time.
What do you think about this big mix-up at the City Hall? Do you think the aldermen are crooked?
Well, I'm afraid I don't know anything about these aldermen.
Maybe not, but do you think it likely they'd be crooked?
Well, they often are crooked. In fact, they're often a pack of bums.
Hey, pack of bums is good. I can feature that fine. Yeah, pack of bums is good. Do you think they took a pretty big graft out of building the new abattoir?
No, I'm afraid I don't know anything about it.
Maybe not, but do you think it likely they did?
No, I don't know anything about it.
Well, I guess I'll have to leave that out then. Hope to see you again sometime. Good night.
Well, the next morning, as I was being borne away from that city in a train, I spotted the following headlines in the newspaper.
Thinks alderman pack of bums. Distinguished lecturer talks on Christian Science. The distinguished visitor,
so ran his report,
gave an interesting talk on Christian Science in the auditorium of the YMCA to a capacity audience. He said that we were living in an age of radio and that in his opinion the aldermen were a pack of bums. The lecturer discussed fully the structure of anatomy, which he said emanated out of radio. He expressed his desire to hazard no opinion about the question of graft in regard to the building of the new abattoir, which he considers to be the finest he has seen at any of his lectures. The address, which was freely punctuated with applause, was followed with keen attention, and the wish was freely expressed at the close that the lecturer might give it in other cities.
Thank you.
The actor John Stark in his one-man show, An Evening with Stephen Leacock. The program was produced by Tapestry Records, and Rick Butler was the producer. Jazz dancer Sam Watson was one of the many artists who took part in this year's Summer Arts Festival. And while he was here, he talked with Claire West about his craft. Claire began the discussion by asking Sam...
Now, by jazz, you mean jazz dance, don't you?
Jazz dance classes. No, it's not anything to do with jazz music, although you do use jazz music sometimes, but it's totally different, totally different medium.
You better tell everybody listening where you're from.
If you haven't, I'm definitely from the South, if you can tell by my voice. It keeps going in and out. I'm originally from Kentucky. Grew up in the western part of Kentucky, right at the base of Indiana and Illinois. And I went to school at Northern Kentucky University my first year of college. That's where I first started dancing, was there. And from there, I went straight to Chicago. That was the next place I settled down in, I guess. And I've been there for, this is my fifth year there.
Dance took you to Chicago?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Gus Giordano, that name is synonymous with jazz, basically. Or when I started dancing, I started out in modern dance. And I was very interested in jazz, but where I went to school, there wasn't a lot of jazz offered. And so I started asking people that knew more about it, who had taken some jazz classes and stuff, who I should take from, you know, if I wanted to take jazz. And they said, Gus Giordano. You know, he's the man. He's the main person that you'll have to go to for jazz. And he has a dance center that's right outside of Chicago in the suburb of Evanston. It's right north of Chicago. And he has a big jazz dance center there. They also offer ballet and modern and tap, but their main emphasis is on jazz. So I moved there, didn't know anyone, just packed everything up and moved there. Got a scholarship, half scholarship the first year I was there, first semester, and really liked it a lot. I stayed, the first time I went, it was 6 weeks, I guess. Yeah, I tried it out because I didn't know for sure I was going to go somewhere else if I didn't like it there. But I really loved it. I fell in love with it. And so I stayed there, and then they gave me a full scholarship after that. And one thing led to another. I worked with a modern company there for a while, and then with Gus's company. And then I toured with his company for the past 3 years in his international touring company.
And are you still with him?
No. I still teach for them, and I'm still on their faculty. And I do guest appearances with his company and different outside shows, but I don't tour with his company anymore. I now dance with the Chicago Repertory Dance Ensemble, which is based in Chicago, and it's a company of everything. It offers ballet, modern, jazz, folk dance, everything, a wide spectrum, where Giordano only offers jazz, a little bit of modern, but all jazz. And so I switched to Chicago Repertory in late February, and I've been working with them ever since.
So tell us something about Chicago Repertory. I mean, you've said a little bit about what they do. Can you tell me who works there? Can you give me some names?
Sure. They have a lot of very, very good names. Chicago Repertory started, it's a very new company. It started about... this is their third year, and it started out as a company of guest artists. Tara Mitten, who is the artistic director, danced with the Chicago Moving Company, which was the repertory company about 3 years ago, and the director of that company, Nana Sobrig, decided she didn't want the company to be a repertory company. Repertory meaning they perform pieces from all different types of choreographers all over the nation, some famous, some local choreographers, and they get varied styles. And she decided that she wanted to do her own choreography for a while, and which left Chicago without a repertory company. Tara Mitten, who was a faculty member of the Graham School in London, had just moved back to Chicago at that time, and she decided to take over the job of trying to get together a repertory company. And her husband, who is a corporate person, he deals a lot with corporate people, had some one corporation he had worked with had offered to let Tara produce a show, a concert, for the corporation to raise money or whatever, a benefit concert, a benefit dance concert. So she called some of her dance friends, and some of them were living in Chicago, people that she'd worked with when she worked with Nina Sobrig with the Chicago Moving Company, some that she knew in New York. One, the most famous, I guess, of the dancers in the company is Warren Conover from American Ballet Theater. He was a soloist for several years. He came and did a guest spot. Greg Begley, who was with the Chicago City Ballet and now is with Lou Conti's jazz dance company in Chicago, came back. Mary Ward, who graduated from the university in Salt Lake City and worked with several different companies there, RDT, all those. What's the Strong Horses, Wild Wind,
Wild,
Strong?
Wild, yeah.
Yeah, you know the one I'm talking about.
I know the one.
Strong Wind, Wild Horses. That's it.
Right.
Several different performance companies there. She came back. Anna Chayun, who is a unbelievable Ukrainian girl, just unbelievable. She's from Chicago. She came back. There were several. There were several. Beth Bradley, who worked with Louis Falco in New York. Anyway, they all came back. They did this benefit concert, and it went great. It was really well received, and they did another one, and it was even better received. It got a lot of exposure in the paper, a lot of press, and a lot of reviews. And so Taurus was, you know, this is a pretty good thing. You know, maybe we should do this full time. And at that time, Warren Conover was very displeased with ABT. He's pretty short for a ballet dancer, and he always got character roles in ABT. And from what I take it, he didn't get along with Baryshnikov that well when he took over. So he moved back to Chicago and said, you know, I'll be here. And before she knew it, everyone was really into making this a company, and they all came back. And since then, you know, they got a board of directors and everything was incorporated, and they've been working as a performance company, a repertory company, for the past 2 years. And they just enlarged the company in February. That's when I had joined. Now it's a 16 member company, with two on maternity leave right now. With the guest artists that were there, there's, you know, that extra, about extra five or six that were added on. I was brought in mainly to round out their curriculum of ballet, modern, and jazz. So that's basically why I'm there, is for their rounded out of, for the jazz department.
It's unusual to have a company that has so many different disciplines within itself.
Yes,
I don't know of very many others. Can you think of... I know Dance Omnium and Fairbanks does that, but I don't know of too many other companies that incorporate all the disciplines, because they're usually so disparate,
right,
and not used to, or
right,
not willing to work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we do, like I could say... they offer everything, but not the whole company. Not the whole company will perform a ballet piece.
Right.
Like I say, Warren Conover is like the star of the ballet, so he's going to definitely be the limelight there. But we do have ensemble pieces. One of our main pieces right now, who a corporation in Chicago had funded the money for, Lar Lubavitch, who is a very famous and upcoming choreographer in New York. Everyone's dying to dance with Lar Lubavitch right now. They had him come into Chicago, and he's originally from Chicago. So it was a big Chicago dance piece. And, you know, bringing an original Chicago choreographer and do a piece about Chicago. And he did a piece about Chicago architecture. And the piece is called Big Shoulders. And... a architect, John Hollabrid, who is a very famous architect in Chicago, was hired to design the set for the piece. And so it was a big collaboration. And it involves all the dancers in the repertory company. And it's a rather strange piece because it has no music. It's all done by the rhythm of the dancers between each other, stamps and claps and a lot of breaths and grunts and what have you throughout the piece. And that's what keeps the rhythm through the whole piece. Lar Lubavitch has always been noted for his choreography being very musical and very flowing with the music. And he didn't want to be typecast that way. So he decided his next piece, if he was so musical, he just wasn't going to use music. See what they say. See if he liked this choreography. And it came out with rave reviews. His company performs it, and when they premiered it in New York, it was well received. And then we premiered it in Chicago. We performed with his company, and it was always top reviews. So that's the main piece we do right now that incorporates all the dancers. We have they have a couple more pieces that we're still working on. A piece by Bill Evans. He was up for a long time in Seattle, but now he's with the Winnipeg Ballet. And a piece called Tintal, which is a he called it a trance piece. It's all Indian drums music. And it has a piece of sculpture on the stage that goes all the way across, and it's kind of a cross between a modern and jazz put together. It has a lot of pelvic movements and undulating of the body, and at the same time it's has that modern bass because of it's kind of a tribal type dance, a ritualistic type dance. So the modern comes into play there. We'll be working on that, which will have a lot of the different dancers, ballet, modern, and jazz dancers in that.
It's difficult for new companies to start up these days because of funding problems and so on. How is this affecting the Chicago rep? Are they having squeezes, or are they doing
well,
all right?
Well, as any company, you know, any dance company, I don't know anyone that doesn't have financial problems. But I'm not for sure exactly how this company gets all their money. You know, the dancers are kind of just, you know, paid, and they tell you who funds it, but it's not necessary. I don't necessarily know exactly the channels that they go through. I know that Tara Mitten, being so involved with corporations, that's where a big part of our funding comes from, is corporations. Xerox, Playboy, Atlantic Richfield just gave a huge grant, a matching grant. Some of them are matching grants, which would be like Atlantic Richfield gave an $18,000 matching grant, which you have to raise $18,000, which would be in benefit concerts, different, you know, box office sales and everything. But you do raise a lot of money that way, and there's several different corporations that will do that. Also, we get funding through the Illinois Arts Council, a lot of that, because we are a Chicago-based company and the only repertory company in Chicago. And with all the dancers that are the famous dancers we have a lot of names that we can push and you know, attract a lot of people. So they're very receptive to giving us money.
So. And your audiences are generally large?
Yes, we have very good audiences, and they're growing more and more as the name gets out. Like I said, it's only been in existence for 3 years, so it's a very short time for a company to grow. But it's unbelievable how it's grown in 3 years. You know, from just guest artists to a full member company with a following and, you know, a whole complete wide repertory from choreographers all over the nation. So it has worked very well.
Now that we've talked about what you're doing in dance, can you give us some background on how or why you got into dance in the first place?
I had a good friend in high school. I was very involved in theater and speech and everything in high school. And one of my best friends used to take dance classes. And we were roommates in college, and so he talked me into taking a modern class my first semester. And I took that class, and by the next semester, I went in as a child psychology major. but it didn't last very long because by the second semester, I dropped all my general requirements, everything, and took all dance classes. It was right across the river from Cincinnati, Ohio, is where this university is. And so I started taking classes there, kind of illegally, because I was enrolled in Northern Kentucky University, and I was also taking at the Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati, kind of behind their back, behind the administration's back. And decided, you know, this is what I want to do. It just clicked in. It felt very natural. But I was 18, and I needed a lot of work and a lot of catching up with what I thought, you know, other people, what level they would have been at age 18, which is, I found out later, is very untrue. I thought all dancers, to be a dancer, you'd have to be start when you're 4 years old. But with jazz dancers especially, you a lot start at a later age, and you just have to work very hard. And that's why I went to Chicago. Actually, in between, I had one little pit stop in between there. My first dancing job at the end of that that semester, I auditioned for an amusement park. This is one of those little, you know, tales that every dancer has, all of their first embarrassing dance performance or whatever, their first job. It was amusement park Cedar Point in northern Ohio on Lake Erie. And, you know, those big, giant animals that go around and shake people's hands in the park. Well, they had... Their characters were these big giant dogs. Big dogs. I was a sheepdog. And it was huge. You know, I had these big hoops around, you know, and all this furry thing. And it was in a children's review show, so we danced in these big dog suits for a summer. And I made money. That's how I made my money, to go to Chicago and stay there. And then, like I said, I've been there ever since, for five years now.
Do you wish you did more modern still?
Modern?
Mm-hmm.
Modern is my first love. And now with Chicago Repertory, I do a lot of modern now. So that makes it better. That was one thing that attracted me to Giordano's. Because with some jazz, it's, you know, you have your basic techniques of ballet and modern. And some jazz has a ballet background. Some has a modern background. And Gus's background is modern. So... it was easier for me to catch on to because I like modern so well. So,
after you've seen these dancers that we have in town for the past 4 days, you've been teaching them.
Mm-hmm.
And could you tell me what advice you would give to them if they wanted to have a career in dance?
They have the enthusiasm. Everyone here is very enthusiastic, so that's one good thing, because you have to have a lot of guts and a lot of spunk to make it in the dance world. There are just too many people out there that want to be dancers. You know, it's the same way in acting or anything. So you really have to have a lot of aggressive energy to, if you want it, you go for it. You don't sit back and wait for somebody to hand it to you. You have to really, really work for it and have it in your mind set that this is what you're going to do, and don't turn back until you break your legs or something, until you can't dance anymore, if you really want to do it, because that's what it takes. Another thing, I think because of all the flash dance craze and solid gold, you know, all the dancers, someone looks at that and they go, hey, that looks like fun. You know, I'm going to go in jazz class. I'm going to be a jazz dancer. And they go in and thinking that if they just take jazz, they're going to be fine. And that, you know, ballet or modern is going to mess them up, you know, if I take ballet, I'm going to be too stiff, and you know, I don't want to look like a ballet dancer. I want to be a hot jazz dancer. And it's just the opposite. It's just the opposite. To be a jazz dancer, the best jazz dancers I have ever seen had a very strong ballet or modern background, because that's your basis. That's where you learn all of your, how to work your body and how to make it do what you want it to do. And training your muscles to be able to be like a dancer's. So it's very important. That's one of my main things I always tell all of my students, is to get into ballet class, get into modern class, if you are serious about dancing, especially ballet class. That's your basis for any dance, is ballet. So you should get into ballet class, whether you hate it or not. get in there and learn to like it. And more or less, anyone that I've ever seen that hated ballet or something when they first started, they begin to appreciate it and understand it more after they get in there. And it's not as hard of a thing as what they had originally thought.
That was dancer Sam Watson, interviewed by Claire West, who is the owner of Claire West Ballet and a regular contributor of Fairbanks Arts Review. And that brings to a close this edition of our program. Join us again September 6th for another look at the local and international arts. For KUAC, I'm Robert Gilfillan. Good night.